You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimina toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Hi, welcome to The Wire. Today is Wednesday, the 12th of April. I'm Shemin and I'll be with you for the next hour. Also, my producer Adam is here with me in the studio.
Kia ora.
He covered me last week and did a very good job. He held the fort okay and I was very proud. So coming up on the show today, we discuss a new public transport proposal which aims to eliminate traffic congestion from Auckland's transport network. We speak with Generation Zero, who are pushing for policy change towards a carbon-free New Zealand. AUT's Alan Blackman joins us for Dear Science again. This week we'll be talking about some new, slightly morbid research that looks at how prehistoric cannibalism was actually not a very nutritious practice. We'll also be talking to him about a brief history of the development and use of chemical weapons in light of last week's events in Syria. We chat to some researchers from the University of Otago about their project to develop new biomaterials that will regenerate and grow dental tissue. And finally, we look at an upcoming series at AUT called Critical Conversations, which examines the ways in which algorithms and code shapes our everyday lives. If you want to let us know any of your thoughts about the stuff that we cover today, as always, 5395 is the number to text, or 309 3879 if you want to have a chat with us on the phone.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
First up, my producer Adam will have a story.
Auckland's transport woes are a notorious thing, from blocked motorways to never-on-time public transport. But with the release of an updated transit plan, these frustrations may have an end in sight. Proposed by Greater Auckland, formerly Transport Blog, the Congestion Free Network 2 aims to reshape the entirety of Auckland's public transport network into a functional, cohesive unit. I spoke with Greater Auckland editor Matt Lowry as to how exactly the CFN2 plans to implement this, first asking what exactly it was.
In a sense, it's largely what is already planned. What we do is we look at what the council and the government have planned and we say, well, can we do it better? Can we improve on that and both present it better and make it and show that it's feasible? One of the problems with discussing transport we find is that there's both a lot of technical detail and also there's a lot of misunderstanding, particularly in the public, around what's actually possible, what's actually planned, and so we want to sort of highlight that. And so what we do and what we've done with the Congestion Free Network is say, well, actually, what would we do, what would happen if we changed our priorities and spending and fast-tracked these projects to really make a difference to Auckland? So we've been for decades building more and more roads and wider roads, and congestion is worse than ever now. And that's same thing that's been seen over and over, all over the world. You don't solve congestion by building more roads. That just encourages more people to drive. So what we wanted to say is, can we change the priorities? Can we take a fresh look at it and show that a vision for Auckland that is actually possible to achieve and within a reasonable time frame? And so that's where the CFN really comes about.
So this is the second iteration of the CFN. Sorry, what exactly is this proposing? What recommendations are you giving?
Yes, so what we did is we launched the first version of the congestion-free network 4 years ago, and we had a huge response to it and huge success with it too. So we didn't get everything we wanted, obviously, but a lot of what was in that plan is now embedded into plans by the government and council. And so what we want to do is shed some light back on that and also bring it forward, because we don't think that we're building some of this stuff fast enough. So that some of the plans would indicate that we wouldn't have improved transport to the North Shore, whether it be some form of rail, for example, until 3 decades away. Light rail to the airport, their government the other week said it would be 30 years away. We don't think that's good enough. We think we need to focus on actually giving people a true alternative of network for Auckland, so not having to wait 30 years while we build a whole lot more other stuff and not build things that will give people more options. So what we've done is we've taken the current plans and rejigged them and presented them in a nicer way as well, because one of the issues with council and government plans is they always tend to focus on projects and be quite utilitarian and just a line on a map. They don't really show how the network will work, and particularly with public transport, you need to show how that route is actually going to work and give people a sense of how it might be useful for them.
I understand that the CFN2 has got 7 key routes. Would you be able to run us through what these are and how they'll benefit?
There's two, first of all, that are largely in place now, and that the City Rail Link, which is under construction, will not complete, but there's still more work to be done, but by and large they'll be in place there. So that's the Western Line and the Southern Line and the Eastern Line. So there's a through route goes through the City Rail Link, and you have a Western Line that goes through the City Rail Link, through the city, and out to Onehunga. We have Southern Line which comes in to the city, as it does now, goes through the City Rail Link, and it goes out again via the Eastern Line. Now, we don't envisage that there needs to be any more routes used in the City Rail Link. We think that's going to be busy enough through that tunnel as it is without affecting all the other services. So we need additional capacity elsewhere in the city. And so because we've already effectively maximising out our current rail network, we don't see any issue with implementing some new systems for Auckland as well to add to that and improve the overall network. Council have agreed that they're going to put light rail up to the airport. Now, as I mentioned before, the timing is wrong, we believe, but eventually that there'll be light rail there. And we think the logical conclusion to that is to then send it through the city and across the North Shore to Albany and eventually also to Orewa as well, right into the town centre there. So you can catch a rail to the beach up in Orewa, which would be fantastic, I think. There's also a spur off to Takapuna, and that would then join through the city and then head out to the northwest, all the way out to eventually Waimauka as well. So that picks up all the new growth along State Highway, State Highway 16 through Tiatu and Matthew, all that area, and all the new growth that's going to occur through the northwest past Westgate out to Kumu and Huapai. So those would be the two-line light rail network complementing our two-line heavy rail network. And then we've got a series of busways on top of all that, which provide additional services to the airport from Howard all the way down through the southeastern suburbs to the airport, from the same on the other side, which is from Henderson through to Constellation in Albany, and some additional ones from Constellation Drive through the western part of North Shore, so Leanerfield, Onewa Road, those sort of areas, and that goes through the city and eventually out to Botany, so through the busway that's been built, that's been built out of Pamua to Pakuranga and through that way.
Speaking of costs, you guys have estimated that it would cost around $13 to $14 billion to implement this plan, about one-sixth of what Auckland Transport was proposing. How is it so cheap compared to what Auckland Transport were going to be doing?
So what we've said is it will cost around $14 billion to build. Now, that's based on costings from the government and their various planning documents and the council. And so what we've taken that and we've just focused purely on the transport, on the public transport aspects of delivering these additional busways and rail lines. There's on top of that, the government and the council plans also include a whole lot of roading projects. We think some of them are unnecessary and additional costs. So, for example, the East-West Link, which is currently going through a consenting process now, has blown out and is now expected to cost almost $2 billion. And now that we don't believe that achieves all that much for what it's doing, and that we could use that funding to achieve better outcomes if we then use that to build, for example, rail to the airport. So in some cases, we're not necessarily saying that we wouldn't build some of these other projects, but we wouldn't perhaps defer them and prioritise getting the public transport routes in place so that there's at least a viable alternative for people to get around the city. Because at the moment, most people have only one option, that is to sit in a car and therefore sit in traffic for all their commutes. And so by giving people viable alternatives, then it can really change how people get around the city.
Speaking of implementation, how do you guys foresee this plan coming into action? Will it require a lot of support from the government and local councils?
So we would love that the government and council to adopt it. And one of the challenges with transport in New Zealand is that the council's in charge of some areas. So for example, the local roads, council and local transport. The local roads and providing public transport is the council's domain. State highway network, which is the motorways, is the government's domain. And there's differences in funding and how they're funded. So motorways get funded 100%, for example, whereas a project like the City Rail Link, which is every bit as important as some of these motorways that are being built, is having to be funded 50-50 with Auckland. Now, we think that we should treat what's called the strategic public transport network, so these busways, these rail networks, that's how the government see them there, that they're strategic routes. Now we think they should be treated the same as those strategic road routes, which is the motorways and funded by the government to get Auckland moving. So we would like to see some changes in how transport is funded and delivered in New Zealand, so that these big important urban projects are also considered in the same scale as a motorway is, and that would involve changes, obviously, and to deliver. But we think that is a discussion we need to have.
So, what's the next step for the congestion-free network? Is it going to be proposed to the government itself?
We've now released it. We're going to formally try and discuss that with the government and also the council. So we'll be talking to them. In time, we've had some informal discussions with various parts of the council around it already. So we've shown the plan already, and hopefully we will get some buy-in with that. And also, it's important to recognise that this year is an election year, and so we need to make sure that Auckland is through the upcoming election is not being forgotten, essentially, and that some of these issues are being addressed. We don't want we want to come out of the election with some strong indications from the various parties. We're totally agnostic as to who does it, but we want to come out with strong indications from the various parties as to how they're going to help solve Auckland's transport problems, and that will then flow through to hopefully some of this will be implemented.
So around, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Greater Auckland editor Matt Lowry speaking about the congestion-free network too. As climate change is becoming ever more of a concern around the planet, advocacy groups are getting into action. Here in New Zealand, a proposal has been released which aims to eliminate carbon emissions in New Zealand by 2050. Generation Zero has unveiled their Zero Carbon Act, which outlines certain milestones and pathways which the government should undertake to achieve this target. I spoke with Generation Zero spokesperson Lisa McLaren about what the Zero Carbon Act entails and what specific actions they propose.
So our proposed act is trying to get a law passed that means that the government will have to set pollution reduction target to get to net zero by 2050. And it also proposes that there be a climate commission established to help the government set interim targets, so it's not just a rush at the end of that process to try and reduce. It's going to be a gradual shift. And it also means that the government will have to have a plan of how they're going to get to those emissions reduction targets using advice from their own policy experts and industry experts.
Why exactly is a proposal like this needed? Do you not see the current government doing enough in terms of climate change?
So we've seen a lack of ambition in climate change policy for the last 30 years. So it's all previous governments haven't done enough around climate change. And so we think we need to draw a line in the sand and put something in place to get some more ambitious policy. So we see this proposed act as a high-level framework that will bring some cohesion to climate policy in New Zealand and put us on track for that net zero carbon emissions target that we really need. We're seeing internationally that most countries are actually working towards this goal. We know the science is that we need to get to zero carbon emissions by sort of mid-century, and New Zealand has signed on to the Paris Agreement, and as a developed nation we've said that we're going to try and do this as soon as possible to limit temperature rise to well under 2 degrees.
How does Generation Zero plan on implementing this act?
Right now we've just gone out publicly with this act on our website, which is zerocarbonact.nz, and we're trying to engage with anyone that wants to around what we're proposing, and there's lots of places on the website where you can give feedback. We're going out and talking to lots of different policy experts and have been throughout this whole process. So now we're just really asking for all parties in Parliament to get behind this act. We really need cross-party support. Something similar was done in the UK. They passed the Climate Change Act back in 2008, and that was done with cross-party support, and it just showed us how necessary that was. So we're trying to get out and get people to talk to all their MPs and say, yes, this is something that we get behind. This is the solution that New Zealand needs for climate change, and that all parties should be supporting this.
Have we seen any indication from parties of support? It might be a little bit too early to say, but has there been any interest in this act?
We've had a lot of interest in the act from multiple different parties. It's definitely too early to say that X-Party is backing this, but right now we're having some really great conversations with different politicians from across the political sphere, so it's really encouraging. And so what we just need people to go out and talk to their politicians in their local area and say it's something that's important to them.
Seeming as this is an election year, do you feel like climate change policy is going to be an important part of the campaigning process?
I'm not sure how much climate change will play a part in the election. In my bubble day to day, it's a huge part because it's something that I'm really passionate about and work on a lot. But in terms of the mainstream narrative around climate change and election, I'm not sure how big a part it will play. But hopefully if we get a lot of interest with this act and have all the parties talking about it in a positive way, then I think that will be a good thing going into the election.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Generation Zero spokesperson Lisa McLaren discussing the Zero Carbon Act. After the break, we'll be back with Dear Science.
Holy shit, people, you didn't see this one coming. Frontier Touring presents Queens of the Freakin' Stone Age, live for one show only at Auckland's Logan Campbell Centre, July 13. Queens of the Stone Age, live. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy.
What happened to him, my liege?
Oh, alas, alas, he searched for a theatre show and never found it.
So he died?
Aye, death hath taken his bosom.
Because he couldn't find a theatre show?
'Tis tragedy, such sweet sorrow.
But that's all, no Spanish flu or poison or like gout or something.
Oh, he was riddled with black death, up to the gills with it. But 'twas the lack of theatre that took this sweet soul.
Yeah, sure.
Don't be a Yorick. Just listen to the BFM Theatre Guide. Tune in every Thursday morning on breakfast and get clued up on the histrionic happenings around the city. The BFM Theatre Guide, proudly brought to you by the Vic Devonport, the best cinema and performing arts venue in the city. Only 15 minutes away by ferry. Check out their splendid schedule at thevic.co.nz.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, I have AUT's Alan Blackman here with me, joining me and Adam today in the studio. How are you doing today, Alan?
I'm wet.
Yes. Yes, it is a bit shocking out there. People keep on like coming into the office and just like with this very sad look on their faces.
Oh, yes.
And with clothes clearly like soaked through. Not ideal, but I have been safe in the office
It's nice
all
and
morning.
Dry in the studio.
It is,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah, I'll give it that, yes.
It's
yes.
Fun to inspect the rain when you're on the inside of the building. Anyway, first up today, we're chatting about new research that looks at how prehistoric cannibalism wasn't actually very nutritious. Talk us through that.
Yeah, no, this is interesting. You say it's new research, but it's based on old research, and okay, so the guts of it is that they're interested in cannibalism, and so they're trying to find out whether cannibalism was just sort of a ritualistic thing or whether it was done as a nutritional thing. So what the author of this research did, he's at the University of Brighton, he went back to some old papers in the literature where four wonderful people donated their bodies to science, and basically what they did with these four people was to determine their calorific value of their bodies. So essentially they measured the chemical composition of their bodies, and then from that they did some calculations and they worked out the number of calories that would be available if you ate the whole body. So
Like everything,
okay. The lot. Now, I don't know if you read that paper or not, but guess how many humans a single human body could feed for a day and supply their necessary calories.
I did read it, and yeah. I don't remember what it says, but I remember being surprised by it.
Yeah, indeed. 60 people.
Wow.
So you could keep 60 alive for a day.
That's pretty solid.
On the calories that are available in one human body. So the majority of that is fat, so you've got about 50,000 calories worth of fat. The bone marrow, bones and everything. The least is the teeth. You only get about 36 calories out of the teeth.
You'd have to grind them up pretty.
You would indeed, yes. Yes, yeah. So the thing was, okay, so he went back, got these data out of the literature, and then was basically comparing these calorie data with things like your woolly mammoth or your rhinoceros or, you know, other sort of big things that were alive at those times. And your woolly mammoth has got about 3.5 million calories, and your woolly rhinoceros has got about 1.2 million calories, and the poor old human's got about 125,000 calories. So in terms of sustaining people, populations, or whatever, then obviously the human is way down the list in that respect, because its calorific value is so small compared to other bigger, meatier, fattier things.
But and, I mean, of course it has less than a woolly mammoth. I mean, it's like, you know, a fraction of the size.
Indeed. And also it's probably a lot more dangerous to start sort of preying on humans because humans are kind of smart and they'll, you know, they'll prey back, I guess, as it were. So his thesis then becomes that essentially it was too much risk for too little reward, I guess, in terms
So
that's the whole cannibalism thing. So you're not getting that much nutrition out of it. It's a dangerous thing. You're better off hunting bigger prey, which might be less possibly available, maybe, but still going out there and doing that would be a better risk to reward ratio for the humans. So the upshot of it was that basically any sort of cannibalism that's been found over history, he is saying, is due to either it's a ritualistic thing, or perhaps in times of famine or something like that, when there's no prey around, then you resort to your neighbour, as it were.
Right, I see. So it was never sort of a staple of people's diets because of its health benefits?
Seemingly not. No, no.
So, thank goodness for that,
We've all learned something today, I think. The original papers are quite interesting too, the way that they prepare the bodies do all this measuring of their calorific values, and you know they chop them up with a stainless steel knife. They specified stainless steel.
I've got some really morbid images in my head of them just poking up a human leg steak. Yeah.
Yes, we shouldn't laugh, but
So, shall we move on?
Yes.
Okay. So the next story today is yet another sad case of poor cancer sufferers desperate for any measures to cure themselves, and this is them being exploited by awful people.
Amen. Okay, so this has been in the news over the last week, and basically a lot of it comes back to dear old Sir Colin Meads, wonderful rugby player and as he was, who unfortunately has pancreatic cancer. And last year it was sort of reported in the news media that he was taking this stuff called Tikiri Gold, and that this was going to cure him of cancer, and he was really optimistic, really upbeat, etc., etc. And then it sort of resurfaced last week in the news, and again with the Colin Meads reference. And so sadly, he's come out and said that no, it hasn't actually helped him. He's still taking it, but it hasn't cured him. And that sort of led to, I guess, a little bit of an investigation of what this stuff actually is. And it's snake oil, basically, not to put too fine a point on it. A thing called electrolyzed water. And so what they say is that you pass an electric current through water and you generate the stuff called hypochlorous acid, providing you've got some salt in your water. So if you take seawater and electrolyze it, you'll get this thing called hypochlorous acid. And that is very strongly related to a thing called bleach, which is, for those of you chemists out there, the conjugate base of hypochlorous acid, sodium hypochlorite, which is just bleach. And so they're selling
this. So people are drinking watered-down bleach.
They are. And they're selling this stuff for $100 a bottle, $100 for 2 litres, I believe. They're recommending that you drink 600 mils a day for 8 weeks, something like that. They're making a fortune out of it. This is all done by a quote-unquote organic farmer in Taranaki, who is backed by a GP in Hawera. And the quote, from their website, is that Tikiri Gold is an organic liquid manufactured from the same ingredients and in a similar manner to the way that your body creates your immune system components. So there are people that don't know what the hell they're talking about,
Right, so that's like a crocker ship, basically.
It is, it is, it is. And then they also have, of course, the out on their website saying that any medical benefits claimed are not claimed by us, they're just claimed by the users. And they've got, you know how it goes. It's the same old, same old, same old thing. And it happens again and again and again. And they are preying on the vulnerable and the people who are just at the lowest point of their lives. And it's just despicable.
Totally.
It really is. They say they're undergoing a clinical trial, but it's not a clinical trial in the true sense of clinical trial. It's not double-blind placebo, all of that sort of stuff, which it should be. But it's, they're just terrible, terrible people. Just awful people. And then, of course, when you raise the thing about the, or somebody raised the thing about the clinical trial, and the guy said, oh, no, Big Pharma want clinical trials because they're all just about making money, and all of this utter, utter, utter nonsense. And, you know, you have a look at their Facebook page. They've got 670-odd members on their Facebook page, and you just want to get on there and just say, look, please, people, don't fall for this stuff. It's not going to help you. And there's, again, one woman on the website who delayed a mastectomy because...
she was giving this a go.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And, yeah, it makes you weep. It really does. Why these things are so prevalent is just beyond me. I don't know. I don't know. But I guess people at that stage of life would try anything.
And so I also read in the article that I think the Ministry of Health said that they weren't planning on investigating it.
Well, I mean, if they investigate this, they've got to investigate all of the bloody snake oil merchants out there, of which there are many. This is very, very similar to a thing called Miracle Mineral Substance, which made the news a few years ago, sort of big in Australia. Pretty much the same stuff, same modus operandi, and it, maybe... You know, maybe we should be teaching more science in schools or something like this. Maybe we should teach these as case studies in high schools and just bring people's attention to all of this. Why are people so distrustful of so-called mainstream medicine? I mean, there is no other medicine than mainstream. There's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine and there's not. So why do people distrust medicine so much? I don't understand that.
Right. I guess it's like if you don't have that particular knowledge and something is presented to you and it's packaged in a way that makes it sound feel legitimate, then it's like how are you to really know unless you have that particular knowledge, I suppose.
I know. And maybe we should just be training our kids to maybe ask questions, maybe.
I guess that, that goes across the board. I mean, in general with, like, just media, critical media literacy, right? That to just be like, hang on a second.
Yeah, where's your proof? You know, show me your proof.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so our final story today, we're talking about chemical weapons. Can you give me a rundown of where these came from and, the uses?
I can. So, of course, the horrendous events in Syria of last week sort of prompted me to have a talk about this. And being a chemist, obviously, I'd like to think I know a little bit about chemical weapons. So they started probably further or longer ago than a lot of people think. So you can trace them back to around 9th century China, the first chemical weapons. And they then sort of migrated along the Silk Road, and they ended up in Europe in around about the 14th century. So what we would recognisably call today chemical weapons. So that's, you know, that's a good sort of 600, 700 years of Western use of these chemical weapons. And it basically revolutionized warfare, because obviously now you've got the ability to not have to engage in sort of hand-to-hand fighting, that you can sort of lob projectiles at your enemy, and these projectiles will destroy your enemies. So, and it all goes back to, as I say, 9th century China, and in particular a chemical called potassium nitrate, otherwise known as saltpeter. And that there were huge deposits of this in China, and the Chinese found out if you mix this with particular other chemicals, then you've got your chemical weapons. And in terms of these chemical weapons, they rely on a particular chemical reaction that's called oxidation. And what that does is essentially it turns a solid into a gas very, very, very rapidly and allows you to, again, as I say, hurl projectiles at your enemies. So so the name of that chemical weapon that the Chinese came up with was a thing called gunpowder. And perhaps people might be a bit surprised by that because you wouldn't classify gunpowder as being a chemical weapon. But it is. Anything where you're shooting a projectile at somebody else is a chemical weapon. It's all based on chemistry, okay?
Right. And I'd never kind of thought about it in that sort of way.
Yeah, and not a lot of people have, okay? So you're relying on chemistry to shoot somebody.
Right, and relying on that that reaction to happen as a weapon.
And that's how all guns, mortars, howitzers, whatever work, okay, on the basis of that. Now, people generally sort of date first chemical weapons to the First World War when they were first used by the Germans and then retaliated by the English. But I guess my point is that this civil war has been going on in Syria for, oh my goodness, how many, 7 years now, there or thereabouts? And we've had one side or the other side of whoever bombing civilian neighbourhoods with so-called conventional weapons, and there's a little bit of outrage expressed, but nothing gets done. But as soon as you put a little sarin gas in one of those projectiles and drop it on a civilian neighbourhood, then for some reason the world gets on its moral high horse and threatens war, basically, because of the fact that they've got this little bit of so-called chemical weapon in it. Who feels more pain? Somebody who's been sort of had shrapnel go through them, or somebody who's inhaled a chemical weapon? What's the difference? They're both going to end up dead.
Is that because the sarin gas attack had a bigger effect, though? Is that because it killed more people instead of...
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, you just drop bombs on civilian neighbourhoods. I mean, look at Mosul at the moment. They're fighting for that. And, you know, there's this terrible civilian casualties there. And, you know, that's not chemical weapons. And Mosul's a great example because 6 or so months ago at least, we were promised that the Iraqi army were just going to overrun the place and, you know, and ISIS were going to be kicked out of there. And then all of a sudden everything went suspiciously quiet in the media and you never heard about Mosul until maybe a month or so ago. And you know, it's hand-to-hand fighting and everything. No chemical weapons there. People are just dying because of grenades and bombs and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see any difference personally. We should be equally outraged at this.
So why do you think there is this distinction in the way that it's treated by world leaders and the media?
It's a really good question.
I'm curious, is maybe it's because a chemical weapon such as sarin gas can be seen as indiscriminate as to who it targets. So you can target a bomb. Obviously, if you're targeting civilians, it's still a terrible thing.
Yeah.
But what you can happen is if you just drop a gas in the middle of a neighborhood, it doesn't really care where it goes. It just sort of goes everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe that might be a bit of the reason.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, things like napalm and stuff like that, you know, do you classify those, or phosphorus bombs, are they classified as being chemical weapons?
Yeah.
You know, they're relatively indiscriminate and, you know, they're horrible things. I just think, you know, I hate to say it, but I think last week there was a bit of faux outrage. I think we need to be outraged by any civilian deaths, by any use of any weapons at all. Okay, so call me naive or whatever, but, you know, these weapons are chemical weapons. All weapons are chemical weapons, basically. So let's not distinguish between them. Let's not be raised to action by these so-called chemical weapons, these sarin gases and everything. Let's be raised to action as soon as the first shot's fired.
Absolutely. Well, on that kind of dark note.
Yeah, sorry.
It's been a terribly dark Dear Science today.
Blame the weather.
Yeah. It's all the weather's fault. Alrighty. Well, we'll talk to you again next week, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jimena. See you later, Alan. See ya.
That was Dear Science.
So,
You're loving Love Bucket, but you need to go home. Your Tinder date's coming over, the plumber's arriving between 12 and 12, or the cat's having emotional issues and needs you now. Luckily, you can now take a little taste of Love Bucket home with you. Bring a flagon and they'll fill it up with your favourite craft beer or cocktail, as well as a little touch of love. Love Bucket. It's also your new favourite off-licence at 309 K Road, at the back of the K Road Food Workshop.
I'm so stoked I won helmet tickets!
What?
The tickets! Hard, fast and heavy?
What? I can't hear you through this helmet! Hang on, I'll just take it off! Ah, that's better.
95BFM's Hard, Fast and Heavy show present legendary New York Riff Lords Helmet, now at Galatos. Powering through 1994's Betty and a blistering set of the old and the new, Helmet live, loud and in your face. Be listening to BFM all week for your chance to win tickets.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Next up on the show, researchers from the University of Otago are well on their way to developing new biomaterials that will help grow new teeth. The research offers huge potential for people with dental health problems and has just received an Explorer grant from the Health Research Council. I caught up with researchers Azam Ali and Carl Leons earlier this morning to talk about the biomaterials, how they'll work and why this research is so significant.
So you know the background that dental caries remain a major public, the health concern in not only the nationally, internationally, and all around the world, right?
Totally, yeah.
Yes. So therefore, we thought there is a big gap on the research on that space, and we as a scientist or researcher, we need to do something on that space. And therefore, we thought how we can make some sort of novel materials. That materials will comprises some sort of biological functionalities, some sort of antibacterial or anti-bug type of functionalities, as well as mechanical, the hardening type of properties, like, the mineralizing teeth, which has a lot of pulp and dentin and the enamel. So we try to produce some sort of materials sourced from natural, mostly a natural source, we call the biopolymer or natural polymer, and some sort of antibacterial additives on that we will add in there, and also some sort of providing the mechanical support to add some sort of ceramic or bioceramic type of materials to make a system which will ultimately add in into this, the defect teeth, or the teeth has a, the disease, or teeth has no function, then we add that materials. Therefore, that materials will recruit a cell in situ within this, the tissue when you implant it in there, and then they will do their mimicking, the mimicking process to produce a kind of, the mineralized teeth-like materials on there.
Right, so the biomaterial that you're creating just basically mimics the cells and then regenerates...
A tooth,
right, I see.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is why I'm explaining the biomaterials we are producing. It is a novel which have multiple functionalities. As I explained, that biological functionalities which will regenerate the tissue, antibacterial or antifungal properties will kill the bug, and the solid materials we want to add as a filler or a additive which will provide a mechanical support.
And so what are the potential uses of a discovery like this?
Okay, so the one of the other things that Azam hasn't said is that the idea for this project came one day when we were talking about, wouldn't it be great to for there to be a material where we could regenerate or regrow teeth? And as Azam and I talked, he has the materials knowledge with the materials that we think could be successful or suitable for doing that. So the aim with this particular grant from HRC provides us with the funds that we need to develop the material. the aim, and there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done, because putting fillings into, or anything into the mouth is, you know, the mouth is a pretty tough environment. It has big temperature ranges. The teeth generate a lot of force.
And acidic.
It's very acidic, and so on. So, you know, the skills that Azam have with developing a material that will survive in that particular environment, as well as have the properties that a dentist needs to be able to put a filling material in the teeth, is really what we are doing in the first part. But ultimately, that was where we started. That was our question at the very beginning. Can we make a material that can regenerate teeth? And we think we can, but this grant is what will provide us with the funds that we need to start the process.
Awesome. So how will this potentially be used in the future? Like, what sort of benefits will it have to people?
Well, I mean, the thing that we're really excited about, if this is successful, is that, you know, as Arvin mentioned, that dental decay is one of the most common chronic diseases in the world. And there's been quite a lot in the media in New Zealand with water fluoridation and with decay in children and that sort of thing. And we're just examples of what it's like in many parts of the world. And so really there's a multifold approach that we would like to do. One is that, you know, we'd like to develop a material that we can, if someone has a hole in their tooth from decay, we'd like to be able to develop a material that we can just put into that hole without the need to do any drilling. So that's the no drill, no fill. It's a, you know, rather than having to get numbed up and for the dentist to need to use drills to remove the diseased tissue to then put a filling in, we are aiming or hope to develop a material where that's not necessary or is minimal. And also in other areas where teeth have perhaps chipped or broken, that we can put this material in and it will help sort of regenerate the tooth that's been lost. And even if that's not successful, our aim is to produce a material that is tooth-coloured and has really good properties to survive in the mouth, so that it would be a suitable alternative filling material for dentists.
Right, so it would be better than a filling material that's used at the moment because it's maybe an easier process, or like why would it be better?
Well, better because, you know, the aim is that it's a material that is
multifunctional.
That's a multifunctional material. It's strong, it bonds to teeth. So, and the reason that you want fillings to bond to teeth is to just reduce or eliminate the risk of bacteria being able to leak in between a tooth and a filling once it's placed.
Mm.
Also, there's very few filling materials that are available that are antibacterial. Glass ionum cement is one. And we want to develop a material that will kill bugs, so that even if there is a need for some drilling, if there's some bacteria left behind, this material will kill those bugs, and a material that's easy to place for dentists.
And I just point out in here, I think in the beginning, as I said, the materials we are going to develop will have some sort of multifunctional properties. Therefore, the difference between the existing materials, not only is a better, also it has a capability to produce or regenerate that teeth-like tissue in situ within this area where there's a defect.
Cool. So what are the next steps in the timeline of the project? So can we see the regrowth of teeth happening in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it is a realistic what you said, that because it is this Explorer grant, we started the process as Professor Carl also said, and next phase is we will progress for as you know that it need a number of phase. We will do this in vivo animal trial, then subsequently a human trial. And then I think realistically 4 to 5 years, or maybe more will require, because therefore, and after that we have to look at the partners, because we will not produce this material as a manufacturer. So there is a number of pathways, but what you propose about 4 to 5 or maximum 10 years, I think we are very optimistic that within this time frame we will be able to produce this kind of materials and the teeth.
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'll just read out a text that we got, a question from a listener. Can you get hooked on people meat and does it give you the shakes? I don't have an answer for you necessarily. I don't quite know the answer to that, but I don't recommend you giving it a go to find out. And if you've already tried, then, I don't know, maybe call for help or something. Anyway, last on the show today. Our lives are increasingly mediated by digital technologies and online structures. This, in turn, dictates the information we might be exposed to, the relationships we might have, and other ways in which we live. While a new series of talks at AUT intends to look at the way in which algorithms and data interact and shape our everyday lives. Called Critical Conversations, the series is split into 3 talks, Space, Origins, and Intimacy, and each involve a different theorist or academic paired with artists or technologists. I caught up with the curator of the event, Luke Munn, earlier today to learn more about the theme of the series and to chat about what to expect to come out of each conversation.
Well, it really sort of came out of this idea that, you know, technology has become very kind of entwined in our everyday and quite influential in terms of the practices that they sort of facilitate. And this idea of like data politics, right? So it's not talking about political parties, but about this kind of decision-making embedded in technologies, so that when you go on Facebook, for example, you know, the algorithms kind of determine what you're reading and what images you see. Things like Airbnb and Uber, which determine, you know, how you start to conduct your work day, or, you know, how you arrange your space to kind of maximize listing potentials, you know. So that's the kind of broader theme, is this idea of technologies that are sort of informing everyday practices, really. And, you know, there's not a lot out there, I think, for Auckland. Auckland seems to focus on this sort of very kind of techno-optimism, this kind of business innovation, the sort of TEDx Silicon Valley
totally
approach, yep. You know, very sort of boosterish, and there's not a lot out there in terms of thinking critically about everyday technologies. So there's these 3 events coming up. The format is bringing together kind of an academic or a theorist with a practitioner or artist.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I think it's definitely like a very interesting concept, and in that, yeah, I agree that needs to be tackled critically, because data and algorithms, they totally shape our everyday lives, right? And kind of create these invisible structures and architectures around us, and then that kind of regulates how we operate. And yeah, I mean, I feel like this is concerning in some ways, considering how embedded technology is in our everyday lives. So is that kind of the thing that you're trying to tackle? Like, let's step back and look at this critically.
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of unpacking the kind of operations at work and these things. You know, they're often opaque. You have this idea of the black box, you know, that these decisions are designed, and then they're sort of folded away nicely into a package that you no longer have access to. So trying to kind of examine the technologies, trying to see, so yeah, what are the types of politics that they support or facilitate, and what are the types of behaviors that they try to suppress or discourage, you know. And, you know, these technologies are not these sort of apolitical, just technical things, but they are connected with sort of cultural and social contexts.
So we've got Space, Origins, and Intimacy.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about each of these?
Yeah. So the first one's actually tonight around space, and so it'll feature Thomas Michael, who's actually in spatial at AUT. He's the head of department, and he's done a lot of work around kind of hypermodernity, how sort of sensors change the way that we feel about space. So, you know, when we put a sensor in a room, when you start to photograph or listen to things, they create these own spatial fields, I guess. So you have these kind of spatialities or architectures that are not from brick and mortar kind of walls, but they're created by these zones of sort of listening and sensing and computing. And then he's joined by Scott Meekins. So Scott's a recent graduate, architecture graduate. And his master's project was around what he calls data textures. So basically he is collecting data from the client of the house and using that to generate sort of bespoke custom architectures. So rather than, you know, building a house based on what they say they want, is sort of building it around their data footprints. So these architectures kind of emerge from the information that we sort of leave behind. Yeah, so that's the first one, space. The second one is around origins. So that is Christian Kalud is a sort of theoretical computer scientist at University of Auckland here. And he's joined by Frederick Kroon, who's a philosopher. So they actually run this course together called The Logic of Computation. And I thought that was a really interesting mix of kind of comp sci and philosophy.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, Christian makes this point that if you go all the way back to Alan Turing, you know, the kind of birth of the origins of computing, it's as much about sort of philosophy as it is about sort of technical architectures of how to, you know, make a computer. You know, Turing's very interested in this idea of what are the limits of computation, what are the things that we can't do or computers can't solve, what is this sort of halting problem, you know, where you have a problem that will just continue infinitely and there's no end in sight.
Absolutely. I mean, will there kind of be touching on consciousness as well? Is that kind of something that might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to talk about, so one of the things they'll talk about is sort of AI and free will. So that'd be really interesting as well. And I've told them to sort of, you know, it's going to be more of a mainstream audience.
Yeah. Rein it in.
So it's going to be, the sort of highly condensed, very kind of layman's version. But, I think it's going to be really interesting.
It's awesome.
Mix. Yeah, and then the third evening is, Juliet Carpenter is going to be talking with Paulette Benton-Grieg and Gregory Kahn. So Paulette is actually a researcher here at University of Auckland as well. And her research looks into basically how people use online spaces in terms of sexuality. So kind of hookup platforms, dating platforms, you know, even things like Craigslist, which has like forums, you know,
right,
for that purpose. Yeah. So again, you know, we'll have to see what she talks about specifically, but this idea that, you know, you have this sort of online persona and you present yourself in particular ways online, and this sort of, you know, this kind of coded identities about how to present your sexuality and what you're looking for in terms of a partner. So those kind of things. So, yeah, how do online platforms kind of mediate sexuality or influence the way that we think about sexuality? And then, Juliet Carpenter is an artist. So she, her work deals with kind of affect and emotion and about how, in general, you sort of, when you put in a camera on yourself or talking to the screen or taking selfies, is how does that, again, like, inform the way that you think about your identity? and how do you kind of modulate your behavior to kind of maximize, you know, when you're taking a selfie or when you're doing a YouTube kind of video in your bedroom, are there certain, you know, behaviors that you take on or certain kind of emotions or affect that you play up in order to kind of play to the algorithm in a way? So that's kind of her broader practice, and she'll be doing some recent work with Gregory, who's more of a technologist. So they're using this sort of machine learning they're training it on kind of poetry and language and getting it to kind of spit out new kinds of stories, and then she's making videos of using that content. Yeah, so I think that'll be, again, a really interesting mix of the sort of social sciences with a visual artist.
Right, absolutely, because I guess they'd have kind of similar sort of theoretical ideas, but then the way that that's articulated in their various works is so different.
Yeah, exactly. The sort of very visually oriented practice and looking at, like, you know, how do you make a machine that kind of reflects these conditions, you know, and then the sort of social science on the other side, where you're looking at kind of how we change our kind of behaviors or presentation of self to kind of get the optimal result from these kind of online platforms.
If you're interested in heading along to any of the conversations Luke mentioned, they're all happening from 6 to 7 p.m. at AUT's WG building on the 11th floor. So the first one, Space, is happening tonight, and the next one, Origins, is happening on April 26th, and the final talk, Intimacy, is happening on May 17.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that's the end of another Wednesday show. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us today. That was Matt Lowry, Lisa McLaren, Alan Blackman, Azam Ali, Carl Leons, and Luke Munn. Thanks heaps to Adam for helping me with producing this morning, and thank you to everybody who tuned in and who texted us and gave us some calls. We love to hear your feedback. And stay tuned for the 1 to 4 next.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.